session number 11206, Reel 7.
Mr. T. Thornthwaite, Reel 7. What were the kind of training routines that you went through in the machine gun section, Mr. Thornthwaite?
Well, yeah, you had a section of six men. It was five or six men, I'm quite sure now. You had the machine gun itself, the MG, that's the gun. You had the tripod. The tripod used to weigh 56 pounds, and the machine gun weighed about 40 pounds. The Lance Corporal was number one. He used to carry the machine gun itself, and then number two used to carry the tripod. And the remainder of the sections used to carry the boxes with the belts of ammunition in, two each. And that made a section of the machine gun. And he had, in them days, it used to be all fours, not like during the war, turned to threes, but it was all fours. And he had four sections within a platoon. And he had four platoons within a company. So he had a lance corporal in charge of each gun, and he had a sergeant in charge of the four sections in the platoon, sometimes a lieutenant, and then you had the company, which is the normal company commander. As I say, we used to go out firing with it, and then practice at night time for night firing. It's what they called during the war, was called fixed lines. You have the gun set on fixed points where you thought of the enemy was going to come during the night, they'd come to these areas and come that way. So you've had these guns on set on fixed points. Well, what you used to do, you used to, during the day, in practice in the desert, you used to go out, and you put a stick or a little metal dot in the ground. At night time, you took your guns out, and one went forward in the dark with this little oil lamp and put it near this stick. And what you did is you aimed the machine gun, the sights, which is you put the sights up, and you aimed it at this lamp, oil lamp, at the bullseye on the oil lamp. So if you had to fire it during the night, that fired at a target that you took during the day on a compass bearing. I used to train a lot with doing that sort of thing. The difference between that, the desert, and India. In India, we had mules used to carry all the equipment, but in Sudan, we had to carry it. And then eventually, we got some 1,500 weight trucks, which we used to use in the desert itself.
What was the role of the machine gun company then in any action? What would its role be?
Well, it used to take flank and fire. You know, you get, say, a company that's going to go forward to an attack a certain spot. The machine guns used to fire over the top of them, onto in front, just like the artillery putting the barrage down, but this is on a smaller scale. And you fired at points where the enemy would come towards them, or they were dug in or something like that. You'd fire at them points. And also on the flanks, you used to protect the flanks with machine guns to stop them coming in each side. They're a very good gun, I mean, considering they never changed right throughout the war, right from the 1914-18 war. They were just the same. I mean, you used to have the old jokes about the machine gun. On the front, you have a thing called the muzzle cup and a fusee spring in there. And one of the jokes used to say, what happens? Because it was water-cooled, the machine gun, and you had a can that you carried with water in and a tube on. And one of these asked the young recruits, what will you do if you run out of water? And he used to say, take the muzzle cup to the fusee spring and get some more water and all this stuff, you know, rubbish.
You've mentioned the name of your commanding officer. What about the other officers in your company?
I knew the name. He was one of the youngest colonels in the British Army. I just can't place it at present. Ardyne. That's it, Ardyne. That's right, Major Ardyne. Because one thing we heard about Major Ardyne, he used to go away from Khartoum for about a month, and he used to go down Africa on safaris and all kinds. You know, because he was in Malta during the war with us, and when I ever come onto that Malta, I mean, there's some hilarious stories about Ardyne. He was one of the youngest lieutenant colonels in the British Army at the time, I remember, in peacetime.
What about your NCOs? Do you have any memory of those?
Lance Corporal, there was a lad called Lance Corporal Spencer. He was a boxer, because at night, part of his sports, I used to train with him, and he had a pad, and you hold it, it's like a leather pad with a handle and back and turn, and you hold it like that, and you alter the positions, and the person boxing, you know, goes, instead of boxing gloves, he hits that. And he used to do that at night time with him. Now, he was killed during the war in Hull. He was killed in a bombing raid in Forstney. Another lad called Lance Corporal Monaghan. Now, Monaghan, he lived up Fenham somewhere. When I was in the fire service, I went to this house one night to a fire, and here's this Monaghan, and he was upstairs, and he wouldn't come down, and we says, come on out, and he wouldn't, because he says he couldn't find his trousers. And I said, never mind, you've run trousers out. That was Monaghan.
Were any of them difficult to serve under?
No. There was only one person, I don't know if anybody else has ever mentioned him, a chap called Pete Robinson. I never liked him. He was a bit of a homosexual, and he, you know, some of the young lads, he led astray, if you might put it, or whatever it is, because in India, there was two lads committed suicide through it, and there was one in Sudan committed suicide through his antics, you know.
And was he never found out?
No, I don't know why it was never taken up. I don't know whether they allowed this thing to go on or not. But I went to a DLI reunion not so many years ago, and he come to me and he says, I remember you, Thornwick, and I just ignored him. And a lad that was there next to him, he was a good battalion boxer, he says, what do you do that for? I says, well, can't you remember him? He says, well, what's wrong with him? He didn't know about it. Surprising, you know, with 1,000 men, but I never liked him. He was, he did go into the stage stuff at the finish when he came out of the army on, I don't know what he was, something to do with comedian or something, I think.
Was he with the battalion for some time?
Eh?
Was he with the battalion for quite some time?
Was he with the battalion? Oh, yes, yeah. He was in the Sudan. He didn't go to China with us. He left there. Yeah.
So when did you leave the Sudan and to go to China?
We left the Sudan on 29th of the 10th, 37, to sail for China. Again, we went by train to Port Sudan. And when we got to Port Sudan, here's this big troop ship tied up. And that was the first battalion coming to go out. And I think I mentioned once before, when I first went to India, and we're on the troop ship, we're seeing these people, these army people of the regiment, stand in the docks waiting to take us the draft up to the battalion. And I seen them standing there. They were brown as berries, and their KD was spotless, Joby, now leather belts. Now, the same thing happened there in the Sudan when we came. We looked the same to them lot that come from England, and they looked at us, and they couldn't believe we were English, because some of the married quarters were on the deck, and they were shouting down, are they English? They couldn't believe we were black, you know, the sunburn.
How was it that you went to China?
Well, as I said, because I went to India in 35 February, and I hadn't enough service abroad to come home again. So what happened, all the people in the 2nd Battalion, which were in Saddam, that hadn't the service abroad, joined the 1st Battalion to go, and we made the 1st Battalion up to go to China, because it would only be half strength. And then the remainder of the 2nd Battalion went home to England. So we sailed for China. And I think I said before, when I left the India at Bombay, the Gateway of India, I never thought I'd see it again. And here I was sailing and I see it again. I thought that was the last time I'd ever see it. In those days, sailing to China, I don't know how long it took. It must have took us about 6 or 7 weeks. It was a long, long on a troop ship. It's very enjoyable.
Where did you land in China?
We sailed through, went to India, and then sailed through the straits near Singapore. I always remember the distance seeing these islands, which I now know through the war, Borneo and all this, but sailed up and past Hong Kong. We landed at Shanghai, sailed into the Bund at Shanghai, and that was an experience, China. I mean, I was only 22 or something, I think, 22 or 3. But to land there, well, to see the Chinese, it was unbelievable. It was so strange. the Yangtze, the woman yellow in colour there.
What was your task in China? What was the job that the battalion was doing?
Well, as I say, we marched up to the camp, but it was an international city, and you had the different concessions. You had the British concession, you had the American, the French, the Italian, the Russian, the Japanese. All that, of course, Japanese, they were at war with China at the time. That was why we were extra troops to look after the British community within the British section. We all had our own sections. And it was our job to safeguard the British section in line with all the other people. We marched up. Obviously, we were surplus to the normal establishment. We were extra to the battalion. We were billeted in a school. UUN Road School, I always remember that. It was they must have chased all the Chinese out of the kids out of it, and and next door it was a fire station. They give us these collapsible beds they make for us, like a cross pieces like that, and a canvas. And when you open it, well, the weight kept it taut. But you had them in the barrack. I remember during the night, the canvas used to split and you had somebody crashed onto the floor. And half of them at the finish were just sleeping on the floor rather than trust these things, because some of them used to fold up and trap them. They used to throw them cigarette ends, Chesterfield. We started smoking the American Chesterfield, a lucky string. And they threw those cigarettes on the floor and they used to smolder. God, they choked you. Right, we settled in there. And then we had to go and take over from another battalion up on the perimeter. And it was just like a wartime condition. We had dugouts, sandbag emplacements, and a great big barbed wire entanglement in front. And on the other side was the Japanese soldiers going down there. Now our job was to stop the Japanese coming into our area, which was a farce, really, because... On one place, used to do guard duty on the Siu Chau Creek. Used to do guard duty there. Now, with it being a creek, it was covered with mosquitoes. And when he went on guard duty at night time, he had a thing like a beekeeper's thing. You put it over your helmet down, and you could hardly see through it. And it was a greeny coloured stuff like the army, and you couldn't breathe. And you had long gloves to cover your hands and everything. Or you put this green liquid you had to rub on to stop the mosquitoes. And you put all this lot on. And you had your rifle. And you couldn't see what was around you. And what we used to do, when nobody, we used to lift her up so we could see what was going on. And we were on this post on the Siu Chau Creek. And we're told that we had to stop anybody, Japanese or Chinese, coming through the wire back and forwards into Shanghai. Well, I remember one night I was on, and the Japanese had this Chinese that had caught going through the wire, and they were just on the other side of the wire from me, and I could see it. And they had a big brazier going, because it was during the winter. And they tied this Chinaman up to a tree just near the brazier, and they threw a bucket of water over him. He had no clothes on, and it was freezing, because the temperature used to drop down there. And he was covered in ice, and then they'd release him and then bring him to the brazier, and he'd thaw him out, and then he thought he was going home, and then they'd tie him up again, and they'd done all this. And I was watching this, and this officer, Major Rogers, come up. Now, Major Rogers liked to drink, with being a bachelor, you know. And he came up, and he was half tight. He had his blue evening thing on, his uniform, with his mess uniforms, and his stripped cap on. And he says, "Everything all right?" And I says, "Well, everything's here." But I says, the Japs have got the Chinese tied up there. I says, and they keep on throwing water over him, and he's freezing, and then bringing up the fire and then putting them back. And I says, "It's bum and disgraceful." He says, "Come with me." And we bowled over to the Japanese area, which we should never have done. We bowled past their sentry on the other side, and he said to the guard commander, the Japanese, indicated he wanted to see the officer in charge. So they took us down this lane away into the Japanese area, which was stupid, really, because they could have just kept us there. And we went to this building and said something, and this chap came, Japanese officer came out, and he had his trousers on with no shirt, towel around his neck or something. And this Captain Rogers, because he could speak English, the Japanese officer, he said to him, "Why have you got this Chinese tied up?" And he says, "Because he was caught coming through the wire." He says, "But either shoot him or do something, but don't keep on throwing water in him." And the officer said, "Well, I'll let him go in the morning." And we come back to our line, and it was rather afterwards when they found out we'd been into the Japanese area. And here, this Chinaman died by the morning with a change in doings.
Did you see a great deal of that kind of thing with the Japanese?
Oh,
the Chinese?
Yes, yes. Yeah, they were very cruel. Well, as I say, we had sandbag emplacements, but what we did, we had a sandbag emplacement, and then we had a tent on top of it. So as far as the Japanese was concerned, it was just a tent facing their lines, but it was all sandbags inside. And outside, we had a brazier. Everybody had great big braziers out there with the very cold weather. At 8 o'clock at night, a truck used to come up with the cocoa, hot cocoa, and rum in it, yeah, and a big Dixie. And the Japanese used to see that, and they knew what it was. And they used to indicate, you know, with their pots to give them some, and we says, "All right." So we take it into the tent, and we drink it, and then we all used to pee in it. And then we used to bring it back and put it on the brazier, and but the Japanese with the tin, and then we used to hand it away over the wire, and they used to drink it, and then used to pass bits of furniture over, armchairs like that, to us for to put in the tent as there for comfort, you know. But some of the tricks we tried on them.
And then, the British troops didn't have a great deal of regard for the Japanese, had they?
Oh, no. We thought they were simple, stupid. Well, they're always trying to be aggressive. You walk up from one post to another, a matter of 1,000 yards, and you had all posts where you had an entrance through with a barbed wire knife rest, as we call it. You can move to allow people that could get through. And had the Japanese sentry on the other side. And sometimes you try and be friendly, and or sometimes aggressive, and they used to come with a rifle and bayonet like this towards you. Now, there were a bayonet fight, and was totally different than the British Army. They kept it like that, and they used to jump and jump back again, yeah? Whereas the British used to move it around and do this. And I remember one lad was standing there, and this Japanese come up, and he was doing this, taking the mickey, and this young Durham lad put his rifle up like that, and the Jap went like that, And of course, this Durham lad brought the boat round and hit the Japanese on the side of the neck and the ear with it and knocked them flying over. Of course, it was nearly an incident. And then they brought the guard commander out their side, and then he said something, and all the people on the sandbags put their rifles up, aiming at us, you know. And then next thing, there was the officer from battalion who came up, and then there was people from the legation in striped trousers and all kinds, apologised, and they were practically bowing to the Japanese officers about the incident. And I have a cutting somewhere here, I don't know where it is now, but it's a cutting, and it says British troops, Durham troops, told to strike back if the Japanese do anything, you know. And it was a lot of rubbish, because these legation people, the Home Office, they were blooming bowing to the Japanese. Because I remember, as I said, we're told to stop the Japanese from coming through, but you had not to use force. You had to try and push them back. I was on once, and the Japanese officer came through, and we tried to tell him he couldn't know, and he just pushed past. So we got on the hand telephone to report this, and I had to join another chap, and we had to follow him. And we went into Shanghai, and we followed them all around the Shanghai in the car, in the cameras and everything, to see that he didn't stop there. And then he came out and went back to his own place. Because I remember in the Cambria, one Cambria in, I forget where it was, but this Japanese officer was in the Cambria. He got in somehow, and he was drunk, and he pulled his big sword out, and he was slicing it round in the Cambria, and he's chasing everybody around the Cambria with it.
What about other nationals? You said there were other concessions. How did you get on with those?
Very well. I used to have a friend in the American Marines. There was the 4th and 6th Marines next to us, the American section. And I start knocking around with this American out the 4th Marines. Used to be a cowboy before he joined the Marines in peacetime. And I remember when he had a few drinks, he was always boasting. A typical American there. He says, I'm king of the Marines. And he used to say, but you're the ace. He always used to do this, but you're the ace, he says. But he was very generous, you know, but he used to get paid once a fortnight, and we got paid once a week. And of course, he spent all his money, and then the next week he had nothing. So I used to pay for his turn. You know. But he was very generous. And then I had a friend, a Turk, a young Turk, a civilian. Now, he used to go, leave Shanghai, and he used to go out in the Japanese area, and he'd be selling trucks to the Japanese, or he'd be buying diamonds. He was dealing in all kinds of things. He'd be away for months. And then the message would come to me in the barracks to say, your friend so-and-so has been on, and he'd be in the cavalry, and I used to go down, and he used to go and join him. And I also remember, he would never pay for things. He used to have a glass and just put the chits in as we went on. And then he disappeared again.
What about the others? The Italians, I think you said.
Uh-huh. Well, as I say, the battalion was in different areas, and then we moved from the UN school to a place called Ash Camp, which was actually with barracks in. It was on UN Road. That's right, UN Road. It was a camp. Now, that camp during the war, from our red books, was an internal camp for the civilians. The Japanese had the civilians in there. There were different parts, and then we split up. Two companies went to Tenzin. Again, it was like India, like Bombay and Dolali used to change round from Tenzin to Shanghai. Shanghai at Tenzin, again, it was the same sort of thing, you know, with the perimeters with the Japanese.
Mm-hmm. What were you protecting in Tenzin?
Same, the British concession in Tenzin. There was a lot of British coal mines, and there was Jardine and Matheson, big shipping company. There was breweries. When you read history, the Jardine and Matheson goes right down to the opening wars when the shipping companies. And all these established firms there, and coal mines and all this, and as I say, we had to safeguard their doing.
Whilst you were safeguarding all this, did you come into contact with British civilians?
Yes, but they hadn't much time for us. They treated us like they did in Bombay.
And how did you like that? How did you feel about that?
Well, we didn't like it, but I suppose in a way they weren't happy in the way we behaved in cabarets and getting drunk and all the rest of it. I suppose a certain amount was their own fault. But during the Chinese-Japanese War, the Japanese blew a dike up outside Tientsin to try and flood an area where the Chinese army was, but unfortunately went the wrong way and they flooded Tientsin out. And I remember I had a girlfriend there, a Russian girl, Vera Spichenkova. And I was there in the afternoon, because at this time in Tientsin, I was on the regimental police with Chelsea Lam. He was with me, Chelsea Lam. Of course, we were off during the day and we're on duty at night, you see. And I'd been out and I was coming back in a rickshaw, and all the blokes was filling sandbags, and I wondered what was on, and they seen me and they were flinging blooming lumps of earth at me because they were working and I was coming in. But as this flooded, I say, and the water came up from the drains, and it came up and everything came with it, all the sewerage, and it came to 16 foot deep in all Tientsin. We salvaged some stuff and put onto the roof of the bungalow, and we're up there. A roll call on the veranda. I always remember the veranda. You had to stand there, and the water was up to here, and you were all standing, and a sergeant in front with the roll, and he was calling the roll.
See, you were standing in water up to your chest.
In water. And luckily, it was warmish water, and we're standing there, and there was all kinds of things floating about, you know. Dead bodies outside and bumming animals.
Did this not affect your health?
No. They were very worried, mind. They were about an epidemic. But I know when the floods did go down, everything from the barracks and clothing and the whole lot and furniture was put in the square and set fire to. It was burnt, you know. But we were very, very fortunate when I look back on that.
You said that you were with the regimental police. Uh-huh. What kind of duties did you have to do with those?
Well, the regimental police, because you didn't, with it only being two companies in the town of Tientsin, you didn't have any red caps and that like you would in England or different places abroad. So our job was to see that nobody went through when they had too much to drink, because the Japanese area was just the end of a street with a barbed wire across. And one of our jobs was to see that none of them, when they drunk, went through into there, because if they went through, the Japanese took them away and interned them. And the other thing was, if they got out of order in the cabarets, who were getting drunk, get them back to camp. Yeah. But as I say, we off during the day, and then at night we're on duty down there. And our provost sergeant was a chap called Ned Coleman. He's just died, actually. Died in the Newcastle General there. He was 80-odd. Used to be in the Royal Flying Corps. You know, old he was. But that was our duties there. And I always remember when they were talking about the flood water, our section, we were from the battalion and his bungalow near, and the water came. We had a Chinese cook. And he still carried on making sandwiches and stuff, and he had a lump of wood, like a table, and it was floating on the water, and he had the meat on. When he was cutting, it was going under the water and coming up again. And the toilet, our toilet was a chair. We tied it up with ropes hanging from the top, and you had to swim out and climb onto the chair, and it had a hole in. And then you had to push it to one side and then swim back to your door.
What if you couldn't swim?
Well, you just had it. Yeah, just go outside the door. But at night time, when we went out, when we were off, we used to go down to what the cabaret has done. They moved everything up to the next floor. which was bedrooms and everything, but they converted into a bar with drinks and everything. So we used to go out at night with a pair of swimming trunks on only and your trilby hat. And in your trilby, you had your shirt, a clean shirt, and your cigarettes and your money jammed down on your head. And you used to leave the barracks and start swimming down the streets. And you come to some places where there was like a roundabout there, sort of roundabout. And old Chinamen trying to get from one side to the other, obviously they used to hang on to you. And I know the blokes used to just do that, you know, and leave.
Push them in the water.
And away, swimming. And you get to the, what was the cabarets, and you come to the bedroom windows, and you go in, and the woman in charge there used to give you a towel, and used to dry yourself down and put your clean shirt on and sit at the table, because I remember I dropped something, and I looked down, it was funny to see under the tables all the blooming swimming trunks, and some of them even took them off when they were wet. And you used to drink, and then make your way back. Guard duties there used to be a sampan, and it used to go quietly around the streets during the night. Broke on sentry go on the front, and two or three sleeping at the bottom of the sampan, a lamp there and a clock, and it was peculiar to see the British Army going around the sampan, around the streets. And, at one place there, where near a crossroad, we had to do a sentry go. When you're doing sentry, as I say, you were standing up to here in water.
Up your chest.
Up your chest. And you had your rifle on your neck like that. And it was really this different points to stop looting by the Chinese.